Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And this week on Soundbites, we meet Brian Terry. He's a chef and a food justice activist from Oakland, California. And he joins us to talk about his latest book, Afro-Vegan. That's in the second half of the show. But first, I'm sitting here with Ava Chin. And she's a forager and a writer, and she's the former Urban Forager columnist for the New York Times, City Room, and has written about arts and culture for Savour. Did I say that right?
Yes, Savour. Indeed. Mais oui.
The LA Times Sunday Magazine, The Village Voice, Bust, Spin, Vibe, Martha Stewart, and more. Huffington Post named her one of nine contemporary authors you should be reading. And joins us live to talk about her memoir, Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. And since you're a semi-Baltimore girl.
Yes.
Did you went to the Hopkins Seminar, writing seminars?
I sure did.
There you go. A lot of people. But Gil Scott Heron went there.
Did he?
Yeah.
I don't think I realized that.
He was there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. There. Anyway. All right. Well, that makes it even cooler.
I
feel like I've gotten even cooler now knowing that.
he definitely went there. So, welcome. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
So, this is interesting. I mean, the way you decided to write a memoir and mix it in with this passion and knowledge you have about foraging and your family and your love life, and you're all mixed in with finding wild sorrels and everything else.
Yeah.
But it's a smart way to do it because you wrote about something you know and are passionate about.
Right.
I mean, in terms of the art and science of foraging.
Right.
And wrapped your life through it.
Right. Yeah, that was the challenge of it, how to create a narrative that was both personal as well as informative and gave people an insight into the different edible plants and mushrooms that grow wildly around us.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a plant and a mushroom, they can't talk for themselves. They can't move, right? These are relatively slow-growing, inanimate objects. So I found that the best way to tell this story was to try to hit all of the emotional points and the kind of different various tensions that occurred in my life and weave in the nutritional, culinary, medicinal information about the plants and give a recipe at the end.
And of each one.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
So the question is, first of all, has your mother read the book yet?
She has.
Uh-huh. And what does your mother say?
Well, okay, so my mom...
Not that she was painted like a bad person, but you were very open about growing up, your dad leaving and your mom going out all the time and you barricading the doors when you were 9 years old. And
right, right.
And the rest.
Yes, yes. So this is a difficult thing for anybody who writes memoir, right? When you write about the people that are still alive.
Right.
You have relationships with them. Yeah, exactly. So what I did was I sat my mother down last winter before I turned in the final draft. And there was still opportunities to make changes. And I told her every single point in which she appeared in the narrative and where I felt like she might, it might bother her. And to her credit, she said that she wasn't interested in reading the book until it came out. And actually, our conversation sparked numerous memories for her. So this is not to say that there are parts of the book that she wished I probably hadn't revealed. She told me recently that she read the book. She didn't go into it in great detail. All she said was basically she felt like my writing had gotten more lyrical than the past. But that was basically it. So, so it's hard when you're writing a memoir about people that you care about. How do you tell the whole story so that the reader is as in on your life as you were, but that's also kind and compassionate to the people, you know, who you care about, who are still alive.
So it's an interesting choice. I want to talk a bit about this. I mean, before we talk a bit about foraging as well, that you're – this creative choice that you and others are making as well, but the creative choice you made to blend that, to kind of try to cross these paths, to pull in your being outdoors in the city and sometimes not in the city, like in Colorado or wherever else, but going in and that with your love life and your grandmother and all the rest. I mean, so to talk about that. I mean, what did you go through to think about this is what I want to do?
I think I was really looking for the moments where I could really get at the heat of the story, moments where maybe as a writer I felt uncomfortable. Those are the points where I knew, okay, instead of rushing past these moments like we often want to do just as human beings, anything that where we feel like anything that's revealing our flaws, any moment in which I particularly felt very vulnerable, I had to learn to slow down in those moments and really create the scene and tease it out and stay in the moment. These were moments, by the way, where my readers had told me, you know what, Ava, I didn't know what you were thinking at that point.
In terms of foraging.
In terms of just reading the book.
They would
be like, I didn't really know what you were thinking in that moment. And then I realized, you know, in a nonfiction narrative, in a memoir, even if the narrator is not fully cognizant of why they're doing what they're doing, you as a writer still have to make the attempt to try to elucidate as much as possible the experience of what that moment was like. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, that's your job as a writer. If you don't do that, then I think you're cutting the reader short.
No, I think I love the book. I thought the way you write, you're a wonderful writer. It just flows and it's very interesting and you want to know more about all this and who you are and your family and the foraging. And the foraging. I mean, from chapter one with the oyster mushroom piece and
right.
Your grandfather had his issues as well.
Yes, he sure did.
Like his gambling.
Yes.
But you loved him.
Loved him, yeah.
And you learned so much from him.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Especially in the world of food, you learned a lot.
Yeah. My culinary palate was set. It was established because of my grandfather. My grandfather worked in Chinese restaurants his entire life.
As a cook?
He was first started as a waiter. Then he was mostly a bartender and a manager of restaurants.
Right.
But he learned to cook from the cooks.
Gotcha. That's
from
what
the different restaurants
that he
worked at.
Right.
And so that's where my palate was set. I mean, my grandfather cooked up an amazing amount of different kinds of seafood. I was eating snails by the time I was 4 years old, lobster, crabs, which actually made it feel very much at home by the time I went to the writing seminars at Hopkins. I was like, crabs, yes.
But different,
it's true. But I could appreciate them. You know, I had no problem, taking a mallet to the crabs. I was like, I wish I had grown up with that. We just used to use like different nutcrackers. We didn't use an actual hammer.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
The Baltimore way. No finesse.
Yeah, no, I appreciated that.
So, but that to me, but I thought you took glean from him. I mean, I think that that's one of the things about writing memoirs like this is that the only time to me a memoir is good is when the complexity of a human being is there. Human being is there. Do you know what I mean? I mean that you're not painting glorious pictures of people, or also just not understanding that flaws are not the whole character, that flaws are just what are part of existence.
Right.
And there's beauty within the human being's flaws, who has that. That's the part when you can marry the beauty and the flaws.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get to in a long winded. That was the word all I had to say was marry the beauty and the flaws. It's what you did in this book.
Thank you.
Right?
Yeah,
whether
thank
it was your
you.
Ex-lovers or the people you almost married or your...
Right.
Or your parents.
Right, yeah. Or my parents, right? Or the people, who passed away, my beloved grandparents.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you do a disservice to the person when you don't include all those various levels of complexity about their character. When you try to protect them by hiding certain things, I think the reader knows. They can feel
it. Right.
You know?
Right. And you can also learn that there's no difference between Chinese, Jewish, Black, or Italian grandmother's mother.
That's right.
They're all the same.
That's right.
Eat.
Yes, they have their own intensity and their own expectations, which you invariably fall short of.
So let's talk about the foraging. Talk about how you, let's begin with how you got into foraging in the beginning. How did tell the story of how that
sure.
became part of your life.
Sure. So, okay. So, like, background context, you have to know that I was the kind of city kid that grew up pulling the onion grass, also known as field garlic or wild garlic, from out of the back courtyard of my mother's apartment building. I knew it was edible because it smelled like the scallions and the Chinese chives that my grandfather used to cook with. I also was the kind of kid that would, you know, fish out of city waters and bring fluke and flounder back home for my grandparents to cook up. So I wasn't that plus my grandfather's cooking with, I think, what other people might consider very unusual ingredients, medicinal roots and herbs, different variety of mushrooms. My grandfather believed, like a lot of Chinese people, that your food is your medicine. That's also how he showed his love. So my palate, and I think my background was really very open for the idea of – and very receptive mm-hmm. to the idea of wild food. So that by the time I started foraging in earnest as an adult, and it was on the heels of a breakup with someone that I thought I was going to marry and whom my grandmother was hoping that I would marry.
She was a little upset when you didn't.
Yeah, she was just a little bit.
Was no good. You didn't have a good time with your grandmother that day.
No. She basically refused to talk to me
right.
for a while after that. And, you know, that was her prerogative. It wasn't fun for me, but, you know, that's how she showed her both her displeasure as well as her love. So after I broke up with that old boyfriend, I channeled all of that kind of neurotic energy that I had maybe would have used for things like wondering who was going to love me or, you know, who I was going to date next. I channeled that all into learning about the edible plants that were growing all around me in the five boroughs in which I grew up. And I went on a foraging walk with a naturalist who'd been running tours in New York City since the 1980s. And from there, I met other people who were foragers. I went on foraging walks with them. I collected. I'm a little bit of a hidden Johns Hopkins writing seminars kind of nerdy girl. So I boned up on all of the great foraging books that existed, you know, from Yul Gibbon's 1962
Wild
Stalking
the Wild Asparagus right.
which became my Bible, to the Peterson Fields Guides and Audubon Society guides to mushroom hunting. And I took all of these together and my knowledge just started to increase, both by learning from other foragers as well as, you know, staying home at night and boning up on my Latin names for the plants. And it was really fun. And it really actually helped me to to learn how to take things slowly in relationships. I was the kind of person who used to jump headlong into a relationship with the other person. It was a sort of like being in love with love. As cliched as that is, it's really quite true in my case. And learning about the plants taught me to slow down. Because in order to really know a plant, you have to see it in a variety of different seasons. You need to know what it looks like when it's a fresh young shoot in the spring, mm-hmm. to what it looks like when it starts to bloom and go into full maturity in the summer, to what it looks like when it dies back in the winter. And this was the same thing with people. I realized that in a relationship, in order to really know someone, I had to see them in those variety of different stages.
There's this intertwining of your foraging and your love.
That's right.
Right. Loving to forage and foraging for love.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, people think about foraging, and one of the things you talk about in foraging that many foragers do is the helpful qualities of the things that you find in the forest, in the rocks, in the cracks of cement, in the backyard, that you won't find in industrial agriculture.
That's right. That's right. So wild plants, wild edible plants, are actually higher in phytonutrients.
Which means?
Which means, like, phyto means plant in Latin. So higher in these nutrients, like antioxidants, than even the plants that we find in our agriculture. Because in general, we have as human beings have tended to breed the nutrition out of our food to privilege flavor. So we like benign sweetness. We don't like things that tend to be bitter, right? So if you ever taste dandelion leaves, dandelions
are – used to make dandelion wine many moons ago.
That's right. Dandelion leaves are really bitter, right? And as Americans, we have a tendency not to like that much. In the Mediterranean, they love it and they – cook with dandelion leaves all the time. But here in the U.S., we tend to privilege a sweeter, more benign flavor. But that bitter component to the dandelions is actually an indication that it's higher in nutrients, those phytonutrients I was talking about, than other kinds of salad greens that we might be looking at.
So in your diet at home, do you – as the Upper West Side, East Side woman that you are now, as opposed to Brooklyn or Queens or any place else. What percentage of the greens and mushrooms and food on those orders and honey that you consume are wild?
So it really depends on the season. In the spring, summer, and fall, it's a higher percentage. So it could be anywhere as high as like 30% or 40% of our diet. But in the wintertime, not so much. Sort of using maybe dried mushrooms that I've collected throughout the year. Wild honey, I still use that as my mainstay. I wish I had brought some for you.
Oh, wow. Love some of that. We're big honey people.
Next time.
Yeah, next time. I mean, because that's one of the parts of your book is about when you learned about the dangers the bees were going through and you first walked into the swarm and pulling out the wild honey. And
that's right.
That's a very interesting little story.
Wow. That was, I have to say, that was so much fun. I was walking across the college campus where I'm a professor, and I walked into a giant...
What school is that again?
It's the College of Staten Island.
That's
which
right,
is
Staten
part
Island,
of...
Just blocked on it for a minute.
Which is part of the City University of New York. And there was this wild swarm of bees that was just hanging out right in the middle of campus. And everyone else was like, what is it? And I realized it was bees. And I called a friend of mine who is a beekeeper who has captured wild swarms in the past. And he basically told me what to do, which is to wait until the swarm settled onto one point, not freak out, because wild swarms are actually harmless. At that moment, they're kind of love drunk on pheromones that the queen has given them, and they're really just on the move. They're looking for a new home. And I've discovered that this swarm of bees was slated for extermination by the buildings and groundskeepers on campus, and I got them to kind of stay it, right? But there was still an exterminator that was on his way, and I had to run out and try to save the bees, which luckily we were able to do.
Well, you said at one point you contemplated even chaining yourself to a tree.
That's right, what I would do for the honeybees.
But that I think we don't understand as far as the person you were with was teaching you about the power of bees, and we've talked a lot about that on this program. People don't understand what they mean and what losing them means,
right,
to
our agriculture.
For everything. They go everywhere, whether it's grains or flowers or whatever that is.
Yeah, they're really important. One of the things I learned from one of the leading entomologists at Penn State was that the pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides that we are using on our lawns are actually impacting the bees as well. So it's not just their use, which is true, their use in commercial agriculture is harmful, but it's also the kinds of herbicides and pesticides that we're using, ordinary American citizens are using on their lawns, that are also impacting the bees. So it would be great. She had told me it would be great if, you know, everyone was just more aware of that and stopped, you know, purchasing these things and laying them in the ground.
That was a really interesting piece towards the end of the book. I'm glad that was there. I'm really glad that was there. So let's talk a bit about there's so much here to pull out of this book. One of the funny parts was when you were in that cooking contest. In the rain. And you won. Should I say that? I'm not supposed to say that?
Well, you know, it's like the spoiler alert.
I'm sorry. They take that back. And you were in this cooking contest.
That's right. Hoping that I would
win. Hoping that you would win. We'll cut that out. Hoping that you would win. And but that was an interesting piece, combining the stuff you were cooking and foraged and what you made, and also the love thing going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Inside of all that,
yeah. You know, each chapter of the book had to have those three components. It had to have some aspect of the plant or the edible mushroom, including their nutritional, culinary, and historic information, as well as the recipe, plus my own personal story as it related to not just learning about the plants, but my own dealings with love in some way, whether it was familial love or romantic love, whether it was love that was lost or love that was found. So my challenge was how to weave all of these things together in every single chapter in order to keep the reader to want more.
When you're talking about Eli,
yes,
I have a very deep affection for Eli.
Me too.
And I love this one piece. This is a little piece. We don't have to read too much of this. I'll just throw this out here. And you said, I put my face into the motherwort and nuzzled it. I could feel the entire plant photosynthesizing under the open prairie sky and pouring the oxygen straight into my nostrils.
That was fun.
So that's a relationship you do have, though, in some ways with these wild plants.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you like to feel them. You like to touch them.
Mm-hmm.
You like to smell them.
Mm-hmm.
Get your
right.
hands in them, picking them up.
Get my hands in them. That's right. Ingest them.
Ingest them, dusting off the dirt from the mushrooms rather than washing them.
And that's right. Meet them on their own level.
You really do.
I do. It's fun.
Part of what you're writing about here is also kind of a lost way of life for human beings, because this is how we got our greens, what plants give us, that what is called the phytonutrients.
Yes.
We got our phytonutrients from finding the wild greens in the woods and on the prairies, and that's where it came from.
Right. That's absolutely right. So foraging, even in the middle of New York City, has put me in greater touch with that, with those old practices. And just, I think, it's really changed the way I see the city that I was born in. You know, I don't see New York as just a city of, like, concrete jungle, a city of glassy skyscrapers anymore. I see it as a place that's actually a lot lusher than I think most people give it credit for. These edible weeds are tenacious. Wherever the ground is disturbed, these kinds of edible weeds will turn up. And a lot of these are not native plants. That some of these came over with the colonists.
Right.
Invasive
species are everywhere.
Invasive species, exactly. And I know a lot of people don't like the invasive species. And you do have to be careful because they can take over. But, you know, I think that for me, the fact that a lot of them have an edible or a medicinal profile and a culinary history from other cultures aside from our own is fascinating. Also, when you learn the common names of a plant and the kind of myths surrounding some of these plants, it actually changes your vision because you cannot not see them anymore. It's something about learning the names of something that all of a sudden takes it out of this like all-embracing category of weed. A weed won't – you will not see a weed. You'll just see like green if you're looking at weeds, right? But if you're looking – if you know the common name and the Latin name and the background history of the plants, they start to pop out as if like in Technicolor. It's a little trippy, I have to say. Not that I know anything about that.
Of course you wouldn't. How would you know about that? Unless it's one of the mushrooms you picked.
Yeah, from literature.
From literature. So when you take a walk, what you're saying is you see it everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Walking down the street, walking through the park.
Right, driving here to the studio.
You saw things all around the studio here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very lush, edible world out there.
In the spring, you talk about some of the things that really, I mean, that I've eaten myself because of other people who've no foraging and have had a chance to eat their yellow morels. That's it. Morels?
The morel. Yes.
Let's say that right. Morels.
Yeah, right. Morcella esculenta, the yellow morel. They're amazing. Okay, they're coveted not just because they're incredibly delicious, but because they can't be cultivated. They can only be foraged for in the wild. And so this is reflected in the very high prices that morels collect in the markets.
They're ridiculous.
Yeah, they're very expensive. And they have a short growing season. Mushroom hunters are loath to tell anybody where their secret spots are. Because if the weather conditions are right, the morels will come back year after year after year. Yes.
You have your secret spots?
I have my secret spots. Unfortunately, they got destroyed in Hurricane Sandy.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. So that was sad. I have to find more.
So I think you've written a book here that marries the kind of things that we really need to have in our lives. I mean, you're very open about the loves of your life. You're very open about your family. You're very open about how you learned about eating the wild things around us and knowing them and feeling them and incorporating them into our existence. So,
thank you.
Good memoir, good foraging. Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal by Ava Chin. Thank you, Ava.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure being here.
We have to take a very short break. Don't go away. When we come back, I'll be talking with Brian Terry, chef and food justice activist, about his new book, Afro-Vegan. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. We're about to talk with Brian Terry. Brian Terry has written this book called Afro-Vegan, Farm Fresh African, Caribbean, and Southern Flavors Remixed. He's a chef and a food justice activist from Oakland, California, host of Urban Organic, a multi-episode web series that he co-created, author of four books, including the critically acclaimed Vegan Soul Kitchen, and co-author with Anna Lape, our dear friend Anna Lape, of Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen. And he's here to talk, as I said, about his latest book, Afro-Vegan. So, Brian Terry, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me on.
So you also worked with Anna Lape, huh?
Yeah, Anna and I met when I was living in New York City. I live in the Bay Area now, the West Coast. But I was living in New York City, and I had I had founded an organization called Be Healthy, which worked with young people, really getting them excited about food and cooking and farming issues and all that stuff. And we were young at the time, so my home address was being used. And Anna looked in this book that was featuring a lot of cutting-edge youth organizations at the time, and she saw that I lived around the corner from her.
Oh, cool.
And so she called me, and we met for a coffee and quickly became friends. And within a year, we were writing a book together. So, yeah, I love Anna Lape.
So I'm just curious about, very quick before we jump into the book, your own journey. I mean, I read in the book how you grew up in Memphis and in northern Mississippi.
Yes.
Your grandparents were kind of southern and rural part of it.
Yes. So I grew up in Memphis, but my family comes from rural Mississippi and rural Tennessee, and I spent a lot of time visiting there as a child, just, you know, being on the farms and connecting with them. So I feel like that's part of my DNA, even though I didn't necessarily live in the country, as they used to say.
That's right, in the country, right.
Yeah.
So I'm curious your own journey, though, because, I mean, it's incredibly important to kind of live with the people you lived with, your grandparents, and be able to, as you described, all the food in that garden and eating fresh food and eating your grandparents' food and the whole Southern cooking, which is just delicious. But clearly, I bet your grandparents weren't vegans.
No. My grandparents, by no stretch were they vegan. But, you know, the thing that often gets lost because of the title of my – vegan being the title of my book is the focus that I'm trying to help people, you know, shift to, which is on farm fresh and garden fresh ingredients. And that was something that I did grow up around. You know, the food that we ate was as local as our backyard garden. It was always in season, and it was as fresh as being harvested right before we prepared it for the meals. And so there are those two kind of threads that I'm really trying to tackle in the book. How can we get more people eating, you know, plant strong or vegetable forward diets or vegetarian or vegan diets, however you want to look at it, but also just really supporting local food systems by growing food at home if people have the ability to, but if not, you know, supporting local farmers at farmers markets and community supported agriculture programs and, you know, wherever we can get local food sources so that we can actually have healthy food that's delicious and nutrient rich, but also ensure that we're supporting our neighbors, giving them the most money from our dollars.
But you are a vegan.
You know, it's funny because I don't describe myself that way for political reasons. While even though I don't eat animal products, and part of that is because so much of my work is about getting people of color, particularly African Americans, given that they are impacted by, you know, preventable diet-related illnesses, heart disease, hypertension, and type 2 diabetes, and the growing body of research that is, you know, very clear that the overconsumption of animal products contributes to a lot of chronic illnesses. So I really see the books that I write as a tool to help people kind of address this public health crisis that we're seeing among Americans in general, but particularly the most impacted communities. And so I realized that term vegan, it triggers a lot of people.
Yes.
It brings up a lot of negative connotations, stereotypes, you know, Birkenstock wearing hippies in Berkeley that just eat brown rice and tofu or, you know, just like bland, boring food. And the work that I do is really about confronting those stereotypes and showing people that you can have food that's vegan, that's exciting, that's delicious, that's interesting. And also, you know, there are black people who identify as vegans and vegetarians and who've been doing this for a while.
Now, going to the heart of what you're talking about here, before we talk about the way you wrote this book and what's in it, is your idea here about reclaiming the Afro-diasporic culture, but food, and as you put mm-hmm. it, come bringing it in from the margins, making it mainstream and palpable for people's lives, and that to you there's a history in this food and in this way that talks about an entire culture.
Yes. Well, just going back to what I mentioned a second ago, there's this history throughout the 20th century of people of African descent, African Americans, black folks, who have been fierce advocates for vegetarian and vegan diets. I mean, we can go back to the health ministry of organizations like, you know, the Seventh-day Adventists, who have often, you know, been very supportive and kind of advocating for vegetarian and vegan diets for their faith community, to the Nation of Islam, whatever disagreements we might have with some of their politics. They were very clear about this health ministry and getting African Americans to eat more, you know, healthful foods and rejecting industrialized foods. Rastafarians with the ITAL diet, the social justice activist and comedian Dick Gregory, you know, who was very clear about the need for African Americans to eat more plant-based foods, even going as far as advocating for raw food diet, which I don't necessarily think that is for everyone. But, you know, and Coretta Scott King, who was a vegan and a really staunch advocate of veganism. And so I simply want people to recognize that when someone like me or Ayende Howe or any African American cookbook writers or health advocates are talking about eating more plant-centered diets, that we're standing on the shoulders of so many of these ancestors who have been, you know, calling for this type of eating throughout the 20th century. And as far as, you know, eating more locally and sustainably, this is simply part of the legacy of eating not only in, you know, the Americas, but in the Caribbean and obviously on the African continent as well. And so for me, it's not necessarily about teaching people anything new, but really about helping people remember these legacies.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. And I think that the way you put these things in the book, I think, are important. I mean, I think that it's when you talk about the connections around people's lives, the kind of food that was created, the spices that were created, the food that was grown, how it enveloped the diaspora, but the diaspora in that sense keeps enveloping and developing throughout the world. You know, it's become part of the basis for human culture, really, not just African culture.
Yes, yes, exactly. And, you know, I do think it's important for me to make an intervention in this body of vegan cookbook writing and simply give people who enjoy vegetarian and vegan food just more exciting, interesting flavors and cooking techniques and classic dishes and just, you know, fun things to work with, a little more brightness in that whole genre. And, you know, I realize that everyone isn't necessarily going to convert to vegetarian or vegan, but one of the reasons I'm so hopeful is that I've seen a major shift over the past decade. You know, I've been doing this work for almost 15 years now, but in regard to people who are recognizing that, you know, eating more plant-centered diets is just something that we all should be doing. And, you know, I have people who tell me, look, I am not going to convert to a vegan. I am going to be eating meat for the rest of my life. But I do meatless Mondays now, or I do vegan before 6, or I don't necessarily feel like every meal has to have meat on the plate. And I think that a book like this and the innumerable brilliant vegetarian and vegan cookbooks that are on the market these days are resources for helping people just to eat more real food and reject, you know, what Michael Pollan calls edible food like substances, that fake stuff.
No, right, exactly. I mean, and it's also, you know, I was thinking about that looking at your book and hearing what you're saying now, that, and I was talking about this morning with some folks on the air about food yesterday, actually, was that, you know, I'm not a vegan, nor am I a vegetarian, but I eat a lot of vegetarian meals and vegan as well, like today at lunch. But part of it is just saying to you, for me, saying to myself, I am not going to eat any more meat in a restaurant from a place that I don't know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. That I will deal maybe with the murder of an animal, but I will not deal with its torture.
Yeah, yeah.
We all have to approach it in different ways and get to a place. And I think what you're talking about is doing it in a way that's not either condescending or judgmental.
Yeah. Well, Mark, let me tell you, when I started moving towards vegetarianism and then veganism when I was in high school, as young people should be, I was very overzealous about this new dietary model, this new way of thinking and moving through the world. And I was, whatever your stereotypes are about the most judgmental, dogmatic, self-righteous, finger-wagging vegan, that's who I was. And, you know, the people who had to deal with my wrath more than anyone else were my parents. And I think that part of my journey was so important because it really helped me realize that the least effective way of helping the people to shift their habits and attitudes and politics around food is by yelling at them, by screaming at them, by making them feel bad for where they are and not meeting people where they are. And so my approach as a food activist, as a cookbook author, has always been about really having compassion for my fellow human beings. You know, I did enter into vegan politics or food politics, if you will, in high school, as and kind of from through the lens of animal rights activism, but and I'm certainly, you know, clear about the need for us to be compassionate for animals and for us to you know, confront the way that they're treated in our industrial food system. But I think we have to be compassionate to each other as well. I really believe that.
No, and I agree. And then let's jump into your book and let's talk a bit about how you approach this whole thing. And let's start with Romare Bearden, who inspired you. And this quote, The artist has to be something like a whale swimming with his mouth wide open, absorbing everything until he has what he really needs.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you this. One of the most challenging parts of writing this book was actually figuring out how to structure it. You know, initially, I was leaning towards looking at the way that food traveled from the African continent through the transatlantic slave trade from Africa to the Caribbean to the American South. But then I felt like that would be so limiting. And the more that I tried to give it some very neat academic kind of like linear arc or some type of, you know, geographic arc, it just didn't make sense. And so I thought that the best way to approach it would be to, you know, kind of look at the food as a collagist might look at paper and you know, clippings or whatever materials that one might use. And so, you know, in regard to Bearden's quote, I just took this period of time where I was just absorbing and just getting a lot of input from, you know, websites to home-cooked meals from friends to scholarly monographs to, narrative histories of African Caribbean and Afro-American food, and just, like, really absorbing as much as possible. And then I dove into the process of writing it, and I felt like, you know, just kind of cutting and pasting and reworking and remixing the flavor profiles and staples and classic ingredients and classic dishes of all these different regions throughout the globe, farm fresh ingredients were at the heart and soul of all that, and that's what came out, this book.
And it came out really very strong. But you also, I mean, the power of where the food of the African diaspora comes from and what is created, both in terms of its taste and ingredients, but it's also the culture, because you've wrapped each recipe around a soundtrack and some recipes around a soundtrack and a book.
Yep.
I was looking at the smoky pili pili sauce, where you used Angola by Cesare Evora. And
yes.
Buck, a memoir by M.K. Asante, who's also been on the show numerous times. So, I mean, tell me how you make these choices.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, there's two things. There is this impulse in me to always combine food and music, because that was just my upbringing. You know, I come from Tennessee, Memphis, which, you know, is a musical town in and of itself. And so just that's a part of my DNA. But My grandfather had a traveling quartet in the 50s called the Four Stars of Harmony. It was one of the first African-American groups to perform on the radio. And, you know, he really had an impact in that region. And because of him, all his children were very musical. So my uncle, Don Bryant, was the house songwriter for High Records, which was the label of Al Green. And Ann Peebles, who's my aunt, you might be familiar with one of her songs, I Can't Stand the Rain,
yes,
which was her one of her most popular songs. And so whenever we gathered as a family, there was food and there was music. There was Uncle Don, you know, playing the piano, and my mother's and our sister's harmonizing, and then all the other, you know, siblings singing. So they're just inseparable for me. And I realized that one thing that our industrial food system has done has kind of created this chasm where food is on one side and then art and culture and community are somewhere on the other side. And, you know, my work has really been about trying to bridge that gap. But I also see the soundtracks and the books and the film suggestions as a way of further educating people, you know, rather than, you know, taking up a lot of space talking about the impact of, the economic globalization on Jamaica and other Caribbean countries through text. I simply recommend the film Life and Debt. And you know, I feel like it's a great way for people to have more context about what's happening with food systems, with local economies in that region. And so, you know, it's a lot of layers to the book, but I always say that I've done my job. If Afro-Vegan moves seamlessly from your kitchen countertop to your coffee table to your bedroom nightstand, then I feel like I did my job well.
I like it, except if you do all that, you know it's going to have, by the time he gets back to your bedroom, it's going to have all kinds of seasoning stains on your fingers and the pages. And
that's true. It will.
I can't keep a cookbook and have it not have, like, pieces of food in it. It's hard.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I don't know if the whole you know, like the digital revolution in books is going to really translate for cookbooks. Because I think people, like you said, they like having the book, you know, having that tactile experience and earmarking it, writing notes, and just like, you know, getting it dirty a little bit.
You got to get it dirty.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get it dirty. So talk about some of these recipes. What there's some, I can talk about ones I like, but what do you like? I mean, there's a bunch
well,
of.
Oh, another. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, man. I was going to talk about smashed potatoes, peas, and corn with chili garlic oil.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
Well, it's funny. I just got an email last night from the owner of Omnivore Books in San Francisco. It's like this really popular food-focused bookstore, and I just did a reading there on Monday, I believe. Monday or Tuesday, everything's a blur now. But my wife is 8.5 months pregnant. We're about to have another kid. And
congratulations.
Kind of crazy around here.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. But this dish, mashed potatoes, peas, and corn with chili garlic oil, is actually inspired by a Kenyan dish, one of the staples of the Kikuyu people, the largest ethnic group in Kenya and East Africa, is a dish called iriro. And iriro is, you know, kind of similar in texture to mashed potatoes that we have here, but then they fold in fresh peas and corn. So I thought, you know, rather than just kind of replicating that, what I wanted to do is do a deconstructed version where I take new potatoes and then I roast them and then I smash them in the way that one would do a tostone, the, you know, plantain dish that people have in the Caribbean. And then I toast them some more until they're crispy. And then I do a very lightly sauteed corn, mixture of corn and peas, and then I top the toasted potatoes with that corn and pea mixture and then drizzle the chili garlic oil on it. And Cecilia, the owner of Omnivore Books, emailed me and said, you know what? I just had your smashed potatoes, peas, and corn with chili garlic oil, but I had them with some seared salmon and a glass of wine, and it was delicious. And, you know, for me, it's just like I love hearing people kind of incorporate it into their way of eating. Cheese fish, she wanted to have with salmon, and that worked for her. And that's what my recipe is about, you know, really having things that people can adapt to make sense for their own diet, for their own geographic region, for their own available ingredients, and just run with it.
I mean, I'm waiting. One thing I'm going to try, it would take about another month, is the heirloom tomato salad and basil sea salt and have Summertime by Angelique Kidjo playing.
Yes.
That's a good musical choice. I like that one.
Thank you.
And then the other one I was going to have, we were going to try over the weekend is tofu curry with mustard greens.
That one's slamming.
That is, man. You call this, is a, yeah. this is from a recipe for Tanzanian fish curry, right? Originally?
Yeah, that was the inspiration for it. And, you know, I'm not super into this whole kind of, and it's not as big of a practice anymore, but I feel like there was this moment in vegetarian cookbook writing where this kind of ethos is like, you just remove the meat and then you add a hunk of tofu or a hunk of tempeh or, you know, seitan or just some type of meat replacement. And so I try to avoid that, but for this dish, it was so compelling, that rich, you know, curry sauce with the peanut butter and the different spices, you know, cumin and cardamom and chili and fresh black pepper and garlic and ground ginger and then the tomatoes. It's just such a rich and flavorful broth. But then you add the tofu that's been roasted in the oven for about 30 minutes, tossed in olive oil and sea salt, and it has this like nice crisp texture, and then the mustard greens, and it comes together to just like it creates it's a party in your mouth. I'll leave it at that.
Oh man, I can't wait. And then at the back you have these menu suggestions, and for different things might happen this spring, a supper in honor of Dr. Carter Woodson, and coming up soon. This looks really good, and I really want to, because you have a bunch of recipes for this one for the summer. The Juneteenth sweet and savory brunch.
Yes.
Fresh
peach,
banana, and warm millet smoothie. Mm. Date almond cornbread muffins.
Yes.
The fresh corn grits with Swiss chard and roasted cherry tomatoes.
Woo!
Millet and peanut stuffed avocado with harissa salsa. Jamaican patties stuffed with mac jus.
Mm-hmm.
And chipotle banana pepper sauce. Have mercy.
There we go. You know, this menu suggestion in the back of the book was really important for me, because one thing that I hear from a lot of people who are, you know, either vegetarian or vegans, or, you know, transitioning or just interested in eating more vegetarian and vegan food, is that when they pick up meat-free cookbooks, they often read as a collection of side dishes. And so I really wanted to use this section as a way to educate people about putting together, you know, meals that are varied in colors and textures and flavors, and that are satisfying, that have, you know, at least one dish that serves as kind of like the main, if you will, something that's a little heartier, something that has a little more, you know, weight to it, and just to, you know, leave you feeling satisfied after you finish the meal. Because, you know, a lot of people feel like, well, yeah, you know, okay, sure, I'll try some of that vegetarian food, but then after that, I'm gonna go eat some real food. You know, I don't want people, I want people to feel like, okay, I had that and I'm good. I'm good until I have another vegetarian or vegan meal.
Hey, man, look, and you also have a thing in the back. You have from our dear friend Michael Twitty, closes out your book with an essay called Think Like You Grow.
Mm-hmm. That was important for me, just to kind of, as a final note in the book, to really get people thinking about the role that we all can play and supporting local food systems by, you know, planting and growing and eating food that we've had some part in producing, whether it's, you know, growing fresh herbs in a kitchen windowsill, or tomatoes in a pot on our fire escape, or building a raised bed garden in our front yard and growing food, or, you know, supporting a local community garden or urban farm. So I think that, you know, a friend of mine once said that when you plant things in the ground, you cultivate them, it's a part, you're playing a part in healing the earth. And with our food system that is being controlled by just a handful of corporations who are dictating what farmers are growing, who are dictating what most Americans are eating, I think the simple act of growing food is revolutionary. And I think it'll play a part in us kind of reeling in our runaway food system and making sure that it's not the corporations that are dictating it, but it's the people who are dictating what we're eating.
Amen. Well, that's a wonderful way to kind of conclude what we're talking about, Brian Terry. And if I could right now, I'd conclude it with the Amy Ashwood.
Tell me about that.
Man, I'll tell you about that. First of all, you pair it with a great song, Africa Unite, Bob Marley. Great song. This is ginger, mango, vodka, lime juice, and cayenne. It is really good.
Thank you.
This is why I started with this. This is how I started. I went back and looked at the food later. I started with that. So it was good.
Well, you know, even though the drink section is in the back of the book, I tell people you might want to start there and start with some of the cocktails, because that makes the cooking of the dishes a lot more fun if you've had a drink or two.
This weekend, I'm going to try the Black Queen, orange pico tea, lemon juice, and sparkling wine.
Okay, all right. I saw that it's like an end of the year, kind of bringing the New Year in dish, but I think you're going to start the party early.
No, end of the season, bringing a new season.
Yeah.
So... Now, this is a wonderful book, Ben. I've really enjoyed the conversation and love this book, Afro-Vegan. Thank you so much for all the work you do and for putting this on our table.
Thank you so much for having me on, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSDL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.